You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Cortina d'Ampezzo.
Cozze cittadine, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze cittadine, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Well, TJ, when you wake up, knowing what you've got to do today and you see the weather, just talk me through your thought process this morning.
Honestly, just try to think as little as possible. We got a tough as nails leader in Hugh, and you know, he woke up and he was G'd up and he said, like, fuck, we're here to race. And I mean, when you have a leader that's that inspiring, then you know, it's easy to, you know, get up for the task.
You've done a lot of stages like this over the years. Tell me how you've kind of learned over the years, or your attitude to them has changed, or what are the sort of secrets of surviving a day like this?
Pretty much just that. Switch your brain off, pump some music in the bus. You know.
What was on this morning?
A bit of Katy Perry. No.
Which song?
What was that? Yeah, Firework was on, E.T., Extraterrestrial. I think we might change it up once we go back to it, but we still have... You got to roll into it, you know? You can't... It's got a crescendo. Katy Perry was like an appetizer, you know? We're going to get to the main dish, probably like some Metallica or something.
Does any part of you... Are you conscious that it could become an epic day and it could become awful? Does that appeal to any part of you to think that you were part of something amazing that people might talk about in years to come?
I mean... Nobody's ever forgotten the 88 Giro when Hampston won over the Gavia and, you know, won in epic fashion. I mean, the thing is, big riders ride big on big days. So this is a day for Hugh. It's a chance to cement him as his legendary status and to say, like, you know, this is the rider I am. And, you know, you gotta relish days like that.
And just finally, where is his head at, do you think, in terms of being aggressive, so, you know, holding on, consolidating? What have you seen from him over the last couple of days?
He's never lost sight of believing that he can win the Giro. I mean, not podium, win the Giro. I mean, that's what the mindset we have. And I mean, you know, as far as, you know, mental toughness goes, he's one of the toughest guys I've ever worked with. And, you know, he's... Nothing gets him down, and nothing phazes him. So there's been a lot of chirping and stuff about, you know, what could or could happen on today, on a day like today. And he said, you know what, like, if it was up to me, it's race on. So,
well, good luck out there. I'll let you get back to Katie. I would have approved the Taylor Swift a bit more than Katie Perry.
No, I'm Katie Perry all day. Are you kidding me? Really?
Off you go. Get out of here.
Sempre poi chiedo a mio fratello se sa qualcosa, perché noi siamo nati a Punta Cana, però nostro padre era, avevamo il castillo.
Well, we opened tonight with TJ Van Garderen at the start this morning in pretty miserable weather. What was the conversation we heard then, Daniel?
Well, the conversation this morning, TJ Van Garderen very contentious about the big, you know, the great rivalry, the copy and battle of American female songstresses, Swift versus Perry. I'm dyed-in-the-wool Swift fan. Anyway, just after that...
That's the big talking point of the day.
Absolutely. We'll revisit that. Well, we were halfway up the first climb, La Crozeta climb. We stopped off because I've been on a bit of a quest. I found out this morning that the plateau up here, the Alto Piano di Cansiglio, used to be home to a tiny, one of the smallest linguistic enclaves in Italy, and an ancient language called Cimbro, and some of the last speakers apparently used to live up here, and it's a language that's derived from German, from Bavarian in particular. There are still a few people that speak it. in on another plateau, the Altopiano di Asiago, 50 kilometers or so away. Anyway, up here it seems like it's completely extinct. I've asked, you know, I've searched high and low for speakers of Cimbro. No one speaks Cimbro anymore up here, which is sad.
Lots of speakers of Cimolai up here, but we
Cimolai?
Yeah, there's David Cimolai fan club.
Oh, because yeah, because we're just outside Pordenone, which is his hometown.
We should explain we're at the top of the first climb today. Sadly, one of only two climbs now today because the weather's pretty bad, and at the start there was a lot of rumour about changes to the course, and then it was confirmed just before the start, really. So it's had a pretty major effect on today's stage, hasn't it, Daniel?
Yes, I've been speaking to some locals, Rich, just outside there on the, by the GPM, by the King of the Mountains banner, and they're obviously very disappointed. No one up here knows what's going on because there's no mobile network of any description. No one even knows where the race is, whether it's half an hour away, an hour away, because we know that the stage start time was going to be changed. Still cold, still wet. There are people next door. We're in the bar, the Locanda, at the top of La Crozetta. There are people warming up on an open fire, which you're probably more okay with what type of fire that is. You could probably describe that in
why is
in
that?
Florida
is that because
I'm
from a very cold country as well? Yeah, well, there's some poor cyclists here trying to warm up. I mean, it was very interesting what TJ said, I thought, at the start, because the rumour going around was that two teams wanted the full stage to be ridden, Bardiani and EF, and TJ Van Garden was very bullish there on behalf of his leader Hugh Carthy, who is up there overall and fancied it. He fancied it. You know, we had a situation last year where there was a lot of controversy over a stage being shortened due to adverse weather. This is a bit different because we're in the mountains and adverse weather can become more dangerous in the mountains. But I don't know, Daniel, you were expressing some misgivings this morning just about the fact that, you know, we've seen over the last couple of years in particular more adverse weather having a bigger impact on mountain stages in particular. And I suppose we fear for these showpiece, you know, huge days in the mountains that are so important to Grand Tours.
Well, I think we should retreat and gather our thoughts on that and wait till the bunch goes past and let's see how cold they actually look. But you are right, TJ Van Garderen this morning seemed fearless. There's a Taylor Swift reference.
I wish I could respond with a Katy Perry reference, but I can't. I'm sorry. Can we go back to the 80s?
Well, Rich, I found some local fans who seem to be enjoying themselves. Guys, what are we drinking? Have we got refosco? What have we got here?
I drink Raboso.
We love Raboso and the Italian wine.
And you guys are from the bottom of the mountain, correct? From
yes,
Treviso.
From Treviso, we live in the bottom of the mountain. And we love cycling.
And your names?
Giovanni.
Enzo.
Daniel, this local dialect sounds remarkably like English.
And are you disappointed about no fedaya, no pordoi?
No, we are very disappointed about this. But I think for the cyclist is better this tour and not to do fedaya and pordoi today.
Better to stand on La Crozetta and drink Raboso.
Better stand on La Crozetta and drink Raboso.
Enzo Giovanni, grazie. Mobile phones flying right on. It's Vincenzo Nibali. Vincenzo Nibali second over the summit ridge, and here come the peloton about 20-30 seconds behind, and it's Lucky Lorenzo.
You asked me, Daniel, who I expect to see first. I fully expect to see Hugh Carthy on his own in a skin suit just to psych everyone out.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
My name is Kevin Sprouse. I'm a sports medicine physician, head of medicine for EF Nippo Pro Cycling, and I also have a practice called Podium Sports Medicine in the U.S. One of my other positions is I'm a scientific advisor for Super Sapiens. For most of my patients, I have them just wear it for a week before they start digging into the numbers. You want to see what your baseline is, how your body usually responds. Maybe the first day that you have it on isn't necessarily typical. And if you start changing things based on a day that wasn't typical, then you end up chasing your tail. And so I'd say just wear it for a week or so and get an idea of how high you tend to go, how low you tend to go, when that happens, how variable you are throughout the day. And then focus in on those times on the bike, your training periods, and look at the same. Like, how high do you go? How low do you go? How variable was it? And then how do you feel? So what's nice in the app, when you get it and start to play with it, is you can delineate the start and finish of a workout. And you can also put in some notes about how you felt. You can quantify that. And so you can start to see, you know, maybe you do best with efforts when your glucose levels are between 120 and 135. Like, you feel really good. And then the next day you go out and you're like, oh, those efforts felt awful today. And you look and lo and behold, you're, you know, 85 to 100. And you realize you were underfueled for those. And so you start to make these connections and realize that you need to be somewhere to perform well. But then don't forget the other, you know, 22 to 20 hours a day where you're fueling for those, where your nutrition is so important. So the time overnight, look and see if you're dropping low at night. And that's usually indicative of inadequate fueling or inadequate calorie intake before bed, basically. Too much burn, not enough refuel.
Buonasera a tutti. Io sono Federica, stata d'Elba, te Val de Fassa. Vedi, benvenuti a tutti, perché è il Giro d'Italia.
Well, here we are warming up after a long, cold, wet day. And whose voice was that did we just hear, Daniel?
Well, Richard, I'm surprised you didn't get that. I'm surprised you're not fluent in Ladin. Ladino.
Well, it's one of the languages I haven't studied.
That you haven't mastered yet. That was our host, Federica. We are in the Val di Fassa tonight. We're in the middle of the mountains. We're at the foot of the Marmolada, the queen of the Dolomites. Federica's first language, as is the case of most people in this particular valley, we're in Canazze, is the name of the town we are. Their first language is Ladino.
So presumably tomorrow morning you're going to read a rough guide to Ladino and be fluent in it by the afternoon. No, that's how it works, is it not?
Probably not, Richard. But, you know, we started the day, didn't we? We heard earlier with a bit of a quest, or I was intrigued by this Cimbro, this sort of extinct language that we happened upon. One of the areas where it used to be spoken on top of the first climb. Didn't find anyone who spoke it. But when we get into this part of the world, into the valleys up in the north and the mountain stages of the Dolomites, we get a bit confused because we found ourselves in places where the first language is German and you can go, you know, a few kilometers up the road and it becomes Italian again. There are four valleys here, the Val Badia, Val di Fassa, Val Gardena and Livina Longo, where Ladino is, for most people, the first language, second language is German, third language is Italian. And Federica was telling me that you can't get a job here in Canazze, in the public sector, if you don't have a formal qualification in Ladino.
This is a bit of a digression before we get into today's stage, which we will. We're not just avoiding it or delaying it because we don't know what happened. We do know what happened. We've figured it all out. And we're going to tell you about it in a moment. But Daniel, we listened to your kilometer zero. I listened to your kilometer zero finally about the Friuli region, which is hard to say. One little bit caught my ear, that the local language is thriving among young people. And I think this is a growing trend, isn't it? With
particularly in northeast of Italy, yeah. And yeah. It's the same in the Veneto region of Italy. The young people do speak dialect. You know, it might be, some people might imagine that it's something that only the old codgers speak.
No.
But no, on the
contrary. As in the northwest coast of Scotland, where Gaelic is generally, it's kind of dying language. Anyway, on to the stage. Egan Bernal's fluent in the language of cycling, isn't he? Very much so. He proved that today. The stage from Sacile to Cortina d'Ampezzo, cut by 60 kilometers. There was a lot of mystery about WAM today, partly because the helicopters couldn't take off. We didn't have pictures of the entire stage. So I thought I'd do the tale of the Tapa tonight entirely in the form of slow radio.
Oh, God.
Only joking, we're not going to do the whole thing in slow radio. Well, just let your imaginations conjure up the images.
Well, today was a bit of a throwback in the sense that we have talked in the past about how, you know, the sort of...
Journalists used to make it up.
Well, the journalists used to make it up. And the epic romantic nature of the cycling narrative was fed and nourished by the fact that there were a tiny handful of people who actually saw any of what was going on. And most other people experienced it over the radio. And today... we didn't see much of it at all, did we? But the little bits, the most insightful bits that we gleaned by standing at the roadside on the first climb of the day, La Crozeta.
And I have recently watched footage at the top of the Jao where we didn't have pictures, but there was, well, one of our producers, Hugh Owen, has sent us some footage from somebody that he knows from the top of the Jao. And it's actually quite informative about some of what happened. We'll get on to that. And when we were where we were earlier, Daniel, at the top of the first climb, there was a big group clear. I thought I saw Dan Martin. I was right. Dan Martin was there. Geoffrey Bouchard was first across to gain more points in the King of the Mountains competition. He wears that jersey, of course. Some other notable names there. Gorka Izagirre, Vincenzo Nibali, Jan Tratnik, friend of the podcast, Jan Tratnik, Matteo Fabbro, Lorenzo Fortunato, Cohen Bowman, Harm van Hook, one of only two riders left now at Lotto Soudal because Thomas de Gendt didn't start this morning. Nicholas Roach was there. Brambilla was there from Trek Segafredo as well. Some good names, Antonio Pedrero, and a smaller group of from that big group formed, emerged at the front and started, well, most of them started the climb of the Jao together. Nibali, Izagirre, Almeida and Formolo. They did, and Pedrero as well, sorry. Gebrezabgabir had been there as well, helping his teammate Nibali, but he was distanced before they began Jao. It looked like they might have a good chance of staying away, not least because it was a group of very strong riders. But behind TJ Van Garderen's bullish talk in the morning wasn't just talk. They really took the race to Ineos Grenadiers, and Van Garderen himself did a huge turn.
Despite the fact with the temperatures, it was like going back to December. I'm not in their wildest dreams. How many of these Taylor Swift references are you picking up here?
I'm not going to get any of these.
I'm going to pepper this episode with Taylor Swift references, and I'm going to see how many you get.
Well, Van Garderen went very swiftly at the front of the bunch.
Who's your favourite Swift? Connor, Ben or Taylor?
Connor, Ben or Taylor? Well, Connor, because he kept an audio diary for us last year, and I beat him over the bridge into Ile de Ré on Strava.
Sorry,
on
sorry I interrupted you.
Anyway, Van Garderen really did a lot of damage. The bunch split up at one point. We're inside the last 50Ks now. There were sort of long valley roads before the Jao, and quite tough roads as well. And EF, who lost Ruben Guerrero yesterday, and he would have been a great asset today, really, as I say, took it to Ineos Grenadiers. And as they started the Paso Jao, the gap to leaders was really collapsing. EF still working hard on the front. Alberto Bettiol now having taken over, and Simon Carr waiting behind him, and Hugh Carthy, their leader, waiting too. We're expecting big things from him after that statement from his team, although, as we'll hear later, Charlie Wegelius didn't really like me describing it as a statement, because they were out to try and win the race. It was the moment when Carr pulled off the front, about halfway up the climb, Bernal went. That was Carthy out of teammates, and Bernal decided to go. Carthy followed him quite easily at first, it seemed, but Bernal kept going, and, well, we lost pictures at this point, but Bernal forged on ahead, and Carthy fell back a little bit. At the summit, and I know this from having just watched this footage, which is courtesy of Igor Tavela, who runs a cycling hotel in this area. He recorded some very good quality footage, if anybody wants to have a look, on Instagram, of what happened at the top. Bernal went over first, about 30 seconds ahead of Damiano Caruso, who began the day third overall. And, well, shall we hear from him at the start this morning?
È giusto fare una passa, una tappa un po' più sicura, perché andare a 2200 metri con rischio di pioggia, neve, È un rischio proprio per la salute, per l'ipotermia, quindi credo che oggi sia stato usato il buon senso.
That was Caruso, the surprise of the Giro so far. Speaking at the start, what was he saying, Daniel?
The Sicilian that seems to thrive in weather for Eskimos.
He wasn't speaking in some other dialect, was
he?
No, he wasn't.
Well, he has been an impressive presence in both in the mix zone and on the road, all Giro, really. Very affable character. And yeah, that was him this morning. I mean, the Bahrain team, we'll hear later from Peo Bilbao, they were very much of the view that the right decision had been taken as far as the route shortening was concerned. But I also spoke to their director sportif, Alberto Volpi, at the finish, and just about how and why Caruso had gone so well in the conditions today. And, I mean, obviously, Caruso's in the form of his life, but he said that the years spent as a domestique for captains might have helped, and it might help on days like this, because you have a better, maybe a better understanding of what it takes to stay warm, and I don't know, a better, maybe slightly more au fait with the you know, different properties of different rain jackets. I don't know. But
Caruso's always been in the shadows, but actually at the Tour last year, he rode a very good overall race as well. And I wonder if that just lit a light bulb in his head. Maybe we'll return to Caruso a bit later.
Well, of course, the path has been cleared for him by Mikel Landa crashing out.
I mean, we were at the finish, and the pictures only reappeared at the finish where we saw Bernal come in and take the stage in with Caruso and Romain Bardet coming together. What I didn't know was that Bernal crossed the top alone. Caruso was chasing on his own, and Bardet was a good 20, 30 seconds behind Caruso. So Bardet clearly descended very well. Worth mentioning as well, Simon Yates had another difficult day, and in fact he was dropped while Simon Carr was still on the front before the big attack, so not an easy day for him today. The top of the Giro was the Cima Coppi, the highest point of this year's Giro at 2,236 metres. A lot of snow piled high, but I don't think it was ever, it didn't look dangerous, even as in 2014, the Nairo Quintana when a descent was neutralized. Was it the Stelvio or the Gavia? I can never remember.
Stelvio.
The stage, once it was running, didn't look in any question at all. There were other hard luck tales today. Alexander Vlasov had a problem. I think he caught his rain jacket in his wheel, and he got dropped just before they climbed the Giro. Got some help from Gorka Izagirre, his teammate, but Izagirre had a narrow escape when he came off the road on the descent and almost hit a car, but very good at bike handling skills to remain upright. Another hard luck tale today, Remco Evenepoel lost 20 minutes. He finished 58th alongside our diarist, James Knox, and we'll hear from him a little bit later on. But Bernal came into the finish alone. Really, he didn't know, that's the second stage win, but he didn't know that he'd won the first one. So he really maximized this one in terms of enjoying it and taking his rain jacket off to show the pink jersey, which was a
among cycling strip teases. Was it one of the most impressive? I mean, I think
It was better than Jai Hindley's attempts to put on a rain jacket last year.
I think Marco Pantani's customary shedding of the bandana was the quintessential cycling striptease for younger listeners. I don't know if we've got any young listeners, but for younger listeners, Pantani
would know if we've got younger listeners.
I don't know if we do. Pantani would shed various items of clothing when he was preparing an attack, and that was one of the, as it's absolutely fundamental to the appeal and the mystique of Pantani, the fact that he telegraphed these attacks and he would pull them off, but it was almost systematic. You know, there were even occasions where he took his nose ring out to save the, you know, 4 milligrams that his little nose stud weighed, and then often the bandana would go last. I don't think Bernal has quite reached those levels yet.
It's not really a Pantani. Well, if anybody's still listening after Daniel's insulted the entire audience, it was a very impressive feat on cobbles, on slippy roads, when he was presumably very cold after that 17-kilometre descent. Bernal managed to take his rain jacket off, and I think that would probably be a gesture appreciated by the Giro itself, fans of the Giro. It'll make for a much more appealing picture in tomorrow's newspapers. Bernal won, not by much, 27 seconds. Admittedly, he lost about 3 minutes taking his rain jacket off, and he didn't. But you know, Bardet, who was second, was pretty close. We'll hear from him in a bit. Caruso finished with Bardet. Then it was Giulio Ciccone at 118. Hugh Carthy just a second behind him. They finished with Joao Almeida, who'd survived from that earlier breakaway. Then Vlasov at 2:11, Simon Yates at 2:37. On GC now, Bernal leads by 2:24 from Caruso's move up to second. Carthy had a good day. He moved up two places on the podium. He's up to third. Vlasov still fourth. Simon Yates moved down three places to fifth. Roman Bardet obviously had a good day on GC as well, moved up to seventh. Tobias Foss as well, not bad, up a place to ninth, with Almeida into the top 10 too.
A couple of DNFs, Rich. Sebastian Heikenbach, oh, he's actually French speaking, isn't he? And Thomas de Gendt.
Thomas de Gendt was a DNS, despite having been through the mix zone in his kit, ready to race, and then didn't start because of a knee problem.
Had a lovely chat with his good friend, we've learned over the last few days that he's identified a kindred spirit in Simon Pelleau of Androni Giocattoli.
Yes, they did have a long chat.
They did have a long chat in the mix zone. But
Imagine De Gendt is Pelleau's breakaway idol, is he?
I think he might be.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to our sponsor, Science in Sport, still backing us after all these years, starting in 2016, and we're very grateful to them for their support. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. We're still running our Super Sunday competition with Science and Sport as well. If you want to predict the winner of Sunday's stage, well, it's a time trial, isn't it? I imagine there'll be a lot of people picking Filippo Ganna. But you never know. You never know. I mean, he's doing a lot of work here. There might be other candidates who could beat him in Milan. If you want to enter that competition and stand a chance of winning £80 worth of Science and Sport goodies, go to thecyclingpodcast.com to enter. Also at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can sign up as a friend of the podcast. The most recent episode we've re-released is Stephen Roach talking about his 1987 Giro victory in a very, intimate way. Four years ago, we released that originally, but that's available now for anyone who signs up as a friend of the podcast. So Daniel, the main talking point today, I suppose, certainly at the start, was the weather and the effect on the stage, cutting out two climbs and 60 kilometres. We're going to hear from our audio diarist James Knox a bit later on about that too. But there was a lot of confusion, wasn't there, at the start? It seemed to be a very late decision to change the stage.
Yeah, and of course all of this has to be seen in light of and in the context of what happened last year at the Giro when it was 2 days from the end, wasn't it? There was torrential rain on the stage that finished in Alba, wasn't it? Or it went into Piemonte. It was a very long stage and the riders were very tired and it was October. There were threats to, the riders wanted the stage cancelled, didn't they? Eventually they rode a shortened stage and they only really raced the last part, and that was all very controversial, and the Riders Association, the CPA, came in for an awful lot of flack over that. The organisers were very unhappy, RCS, Mauro Vegni, the race director in particular. Yesterday, Rich, the delegate for the CPA, the Riders Association, here at the Giro, and he's the head of the Italian Riders Association, but the delegate of the whole association here, Christian Salvato, was in the mix zone. He was floating about, and I think I alluded to this in the podcast yesterday. He was central to what talks had we found out this morning, been taking place for 24 hours about this stage. Christian Salvato was in the mix zone again this morning, just after we found out that the stage had been shortened. And I asked him exactly what had happened and why.
Un input, diciamo, e ringrazio comunque anche l'organizzatore per aver capito questa situazione.
No, it wasn't the extreme weather protocol that led to the stage being changed today. It needed our input. I also thank the organizers for understanding the situation. We're really sorry to have to cut such a beautiful stage, but it'll be a great show anyway, and it'll all be fine. Did we hesitate to make this request after what had happened last year? Well, last year mistakes were made, but I think here we've done the right thing. We started talking yesterday morning, but the decision was only taken this morning, because with all our heart we hoped to do it. The riders wanted to do it, honour the stage, and now they'll honour the shortened version. You're telling me you heard that EF and Bardiani wanted to do the original route? Well, my answer to that is that I go with the majority.
So, Rich, for the avoidance of doubt, this wasn't about the UCI's extreme weather protocol, which has been in place since 2016. That could possibly have been invoked, although I'm not sure the conditions today really met the criteria. But it was more a sensible, as far as they saw it, compromise between RCS and the teams. And we thought the riders, we didn't know how involved the riders had been in the decision making, to avoid basically what happened last year, to avoid a very embarrassing situation where the decision was made minutes before the start and they were all at sort of cross purposes. And today there was at least an attempt made to make it appear as though they were all singing from the same hymn sheet.
That was interesting because, well, Adam Hansen in particular came in for a lot of flack last year for being seen as the riders' leader in demanding this. And they were really at loggerheads there with RCS and Marovegni. Here today was very, very different. It was, and well, what James Knox says about this is interesting too. We weren't really aware of riders being disgruntled or calling for the stage to be shortened. Now, that could be because the riders have been burned. You know, if they put their heads above the parapet, and certainly if they voice an opinion on social media, they know not to do that now. So they may well have been, the CPA WhatsApp groups. Each team has a rider who's a kind of delegate who, and they talk to each other and come up with all, discuss all these things together. But RCS seemed remarkably, I think, relaxed about the changes to this stage. And we know now, of course, and they would have known a lot earlier, that there were no television pictures for a lot of the stage. So today was the Queen stage, the big spectacle. It's that old, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's around to hear it, doesn't make a sound. You know, if there aren't TV pictures, is there any point in taking the risk, I suppose, of the stage that was originally planned? There's another point here as well, just before you come in on that. It so happens that Bernal is so superior that it didn't matter. We still had a great stage, actually. And what I can imagine, if the stage had been the original stage, is that Bernal would have won by even more.
I think the only reason that people might be slightly disgruntled tonight is that they know what they missed. If they didn't know what they missed, what they would have seen today was a Dolomite mountain stage with big time gaps, and it didn't really feel watered down or decaffeinated. It's just they know they'd been looking forward to the Jao at the Fedaya, which, you know, in all likelihood they would have, Ineos would have ridden tempo over both of those climbs.
If there was no possibility of seeing it as viewers, is there any great loss in losing it?
No, probably not. And but you know, this being cycling, as you said, you alluded there to the issue of the television pictures, and people might suspect that Rai or RCS, knowing that those climbs weren't going to be shown anyway, might have thought, well, it's only going to be more embarrassment if we can't show three climbs, so why not shorten the stage? Another, you know, conspiracy theory, another ulterior motive that people might detect. It was noticeable, well, we heard from TJ Van Garderen, and we got the impression that we heard rumours that EF were very much up for it this morning. Well, people might say that EF appeared to be up for it because last year they came in for an awful lot of flack for the letter that they wrote to the race direction asking for the Giro to be halted because of COVID.
Another little interesting point about this, and it's interesting to consider the importance of television pictures to maybe the decision making today, but the most famous stage in Giro history maybe is the Gavia stage in 1988, not won by Andy Hampson, but where Andy Hampson really laid the foundations for his overall win. There were no TV pictures that day either. I mean, that is a stage that's taken on mythological status.
It was actually 25 degrees and sunny.
But it's taken on mythological status precisely because we didn't see it. You know, and we did an episode with Andy Hampson last year about that stage. And when I went back to try and research it, there's so little footage of it. There's even less than there was today. We know the pictures, we've seen all the photographs, but in terms of what happened on the day, nobody saw it. And yet it's still is a stage that we talk about and that is a very important stage in Giro history. And inevitably, there are comparisons. When stages like today's are altered in the way they are, we think back to this stage in snow, and riders in recently bought ski gloves and so on, and think, well, if they did it then, surely they could do it now.
Should we hear, before we go on with this debate, should we hear from a rider? And you mentioned ski gloves there. I was very intrigued by the little patches that Peo Bilbao was wearing on the back of his hands when he appeared and he presented himself to speak to me in the mix zone today. So I asked him about them.
So what have you heard this morning about the stage being changed, and when did you find out that it had been changed?
Until 10, 15 minutes, we didn't know nothing, no. We were expecting this change, but just in case, we were prepared with all this hot material, no, to try to keep the temperature and preparing for a very difficult, hard stage. In the end, it's going to be, I think, intelligent decision from part of the organizers, no, because it was difficult to guarantee that today the whole stage could be done. So yeah, in the end, good decision for everybody, I think.
You just pointed to some patches on your hands, Peo, on the back of your hands. What are they?
Yeah, I have cream and patches from all over the the body, no.
What do they do?
Just to keep the temperature, they give a bit of it's just hot patches, and yeah, to try to keep the temperature. No, I suffer a lot with rain and cold, so just doing everything that was possible for us.
And just lastly, so the temperature on the Giro and the Porto d'Oia, I think, is about zero. Was it? I mean, obviously, it's the descents that everyone is most worried about. That's where you get most cold. But also, I think it's snowing up there now.
Well, now I think we don't need to be worried. No, just the first climb and the last in Giro. In the climb, we are not gonna have any problem. Also, if it is snowing, we don't have problem. No, the problem would be just in the descents that. More than 10k on descents with less than 0 degrees and also snowing would be too dangerous.
So that was another rider, Rich, Peo Bilbao, this morning saying a sensible decision had been taken. But I think what we're seeing here, and we've discussed this before, this is part of a very long-term transition of professional cycling from the realm of the epic and the heroic and the extreme to a different kind of extreme. It's still an extreme sport, but it's extreme in different ways. It's incredibly fast. But, you know, I mean, I was looking earlier, thinking back to times when it was a real test of pure survival. Last year, the Tour de France started in Nice, and that was where the first rider died on the Tour de France, a guy called Adolphe Hélier, stage in Nice. It was a 345-kilometer stage the night before he arrived in Nice. There were no hotel rooms left, and he slept on the beach. The next morning, he went for a slap. The next day, it was a rest day. He went for a slap-up dinner and then an ice cream, and he went to swim in the sea afterwards and drowned. Either because of exhaustion or there were theories about him being stung by a jellyfish. Anyway, that is a completely, completely different sport, completely different entity to what professional cycling is now.
You get very few riders stung by jellyfish.
No,
these days.
But, you know, now if they're not back at the bus 50 minutes after the finish, the bus leaves without them. You know, everything is set up in a completely different way. And, you know, I've got a piece here from Cristiano Gatti, an Italian journalist who's an excellent writer, and he writes these sort of daily polemics. But he says, you know, we can't call them heroes anymore. Well, again, the survivalist aspect of professional cycling has possibly gone. I mean, I'm loath to use the term or use the phrase playing the health card, but we heard a few riders this morning saying, oh, well, our health is in danger. I mean, there are doctors on every team. There's a medical team behind the race. It's not great for their health to go over climbs 2,200 meters high, but it's probably unlikely that someone would die of hypothermia. It is probably unlikely. However, is it necessary to see them suffer to the extent where, you know, they might get ill or that there might be ice on the road and they might slip off? Do we want that? Do we need that? Is that essential to the appeal and to the spectacle?
I don't think the argument that death is unlikely, therefore it's okay, will really fly. I mean, I think you and I were standing at the top of the first climb, Daniel, and we both said that our sympathy for the riders increased immeasurably just by being roadside, by witnessing the cold, the wet, and the sight of the riders, especially in the gruppetto, who were already in a battle for survival. It was still a very hard stage, 153 kilometers. You know, had it been originally 153 kilometers, I wonder if it would have been shortened further. I mean, today was originally a monster stage. I mean, Elia Viviani would have paid €1,000 not to ride it. It was a horrific stage, even in beautiful sunshine, you know, which is kind of what you might get at this time of the year ordinarily. There is a balance, and sometimes the decision will be wrong and sometimes it will be right. And it's good to, I think we've moved on as well from 1988. Although that is a mythological stage, it was kind of crazy. It was dangerous. The footage that you can see illustrates that point. It was dangerous, and the descents in particular were dangerous. There are all sorts of things that come into this. You know, clothing is better. Disc brakes make a big difference without entering into that debate.
Knowing what conditions await you.
But I think the riders are skinnier. I think the riders are carrying less fat. You just have to look at them to see that. So they're maybe more vulnerable as well to extreme cold.
There is a legitimate fear among the fans that we will, you know, we cherish and we mythologize these days like the Gavia. And there is a genuine concern, and it's a legitimate concern, I would say, that we will never see those days again. And they are often the days that have, you know, contributed to the folklore of this sport, and people don't want those days to be a thing of the past and to be obsolete.
There was a sort of a circle closed or unfinished business completed for Bernal today, who may well have won the stage to Tien in 2019 when he won the Tour de France, of course. Although Matt White maintains that Simon Yates would have won it. But that stage was obviously halted by landslides. I mean, that day was different. There was no way they could run the race to the finish because the road had been blocked. So there was a sort of nice sort of symmetry almost to today's victory by Bernal. But and I don't think there's an asterisk against the stage at all. I mean, I think, as I say, had it been longer and had it included those two other major climbs, he would have only won by more time. But a team that really deserved a lot of credit today for the way they took it on was EF Education Nippo, to give them their proper name. And I spoke at the finish to their sports director, Charlie Wigelius.
We spoke to TJ this morning. He was very bullish and said that Hugh was very bullish as well. And you really came out there with obviously a plan. What was that plan, and what happened on the road, was that pretty much what you had planned?
Considering they were sat on the bus with that weather outside, they were extremely motivated this morning, and that's obviously a great sign. And basically the way the race was panning out, it wasn't playing to Hugh's characteristics. It's a little bit like the Zonkerland stage, the route of today. It just doesn't suit his style of riding compared to his rivals when it plays out like that. So we did what we could to try to basically mould the race into a race that would be better for him. And I think if you look at the fact that he's now third overall, and Yates is now behind him and Vlasov is now behind him, I think it was a pretty good operation.
Ineos have been very strong, but we saw a very strong EF today. And as you had just mentioned, you're missing your two best climbers. Guerrero's loss yesterday would be a real blow. But you must be pleased. And TJ again said this morning that having a leader like Hugh, who wasn't daunted at all by this weather and was quite up for it, that helps them a lot, I guess.
We've got some great riders left on the bus, you know, and I think it's nice for them to have the platform to show you guys what they can do, because they've actually been riding great for the last however many days. But unfortunately, you don't always see that in the TV. But if they've delivered him to this point of the race the way he is, it's down to the work that they've all done until now, not just today.
And how is Hugh after that stage? Is he happy? Does he still feel there's a lot of the Giro left to race?
I mean, I think you know Hugh a bit, don't you? He's not never going to be over ecstatic. He'll be complaining about the weather, probably. No, but joking apart, I think he knows he did a good race, and I think that the riders deep down also know that they did a great job today.
Is it important in his development as a leader too that you try something like you tried today and really kind of make a bit of a statement like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're racing to make statements, you know. We're racing with pretty clear ideas about what we're trying to achieve. But I do think it's important that they have the courage to do it when the chance comes and they don't have to be afraid of anybody.
Well, Rich, I suppose EF were one of the winners, were among the winners of the day, not least because of the style in which they rode. As aggressive as they were, we've been slightly concerned, haven't we, that teams and riders might not bow to Egan Bernal's superiority, but not really be able to do much. And there have been a couple of, there have definitely been some flourishes from Astana at the weekend. There was from EF today. And we also saw a bit of a resurgence today from Romain Bardet, didn't we, of DSM. He's not on the podium places, in the podium places yet, but they are back on the agenda, aren't they, for Bardet, I would suggest, after today's stage. He's seventh overall, 5 minutes, 2 seconds down on Bernal, but only, well, he's just under 3 minutes down on Caruso, who's in second. So he's in with a shout for the podium. And he was very happy when he came over the line. And over the course of our 45-second interview, he became less happy, not because of the questions I asked, because he was getting very cold.
Romain, you're pretty much the only man coming over the line smiling. You seem pretty happy with that. We saw almost nothing after Bernal attacked. So just tell us from your point of view, from that moment, what happened?
Yeah, Bernal once again was the strongest, and I was just behind with Caruso and just took my own pace until the top and do the most in the downhill, and then it was finally a good ride for me. So I'm really...
And you're starting to shiver. I mean, how much of a problem was the cold today?
Yeah, it was, but it was already super cold, but the stage had to be shortened, so it's good.
That was Romain Bardet, and I was there too, and the suddenness with which he started to be affected by the cold was pretty alarming. You know,
Almost the second I asked the question. Yeah.
The frost descended. But he, obviously the adrenaline was pumping, and he was pretty chipper. There was a friend of his on the other side of the road, as a spectator. He went and greeted them, and he was... fresh as a daisy, and then very suddenly he began shaking and shivering, and I guess that would have been the case for a lot of riders today. But Bardet goes well in the cold, doesn't he? And he's a very good descender too. He's a good bike handler. And I was speaking to his press officer at the team, Emily Bramier, about him. They've had a lot of GC riders in the past, but no one with the experience of Bardet, and she was saying how relaxed he is. And he told me last week in an interview I did with him that he was aiming for the podium here. Another thing I said to her was that, you know, that the race lacks a bit of interest because Bernal is so superior. And she said, yeah, but there's a lot of interest in the other placings. And that got me thinking about Drive to Survive, the Netflix series. What that does so brilliantly is it makes you interested in the battle for sixth and seventh place. A whole episode can be about that. And it becomes very interesting as soon as you're invested in the characters. And that's maybe what cycling's lacking. Maybe that's our failure. Because behind Bernal, there is a lot of competition there for the placings in the top 10. You know, Almeida's kind of resurgent as well. Foss is riding a good race.
Simon Yates today, there were people who were following the race, for example, on motorbikes, who thought they saw Simon Yates in a lot of trouble. And they worried that today saw a return of whatever issues that he complained to us about, or he sort of hinted at in his interview with us yesterday. He had muscular issues in the first week, and he was struggling at the top of the climb, at the top of the Jao, and on the descent as well. Looked slightly uncomfortable pedaling, I was told.
Daniel, we've still got to hear from our audio diarist, and it's another raw and kind of honest installment from James Knox. But before that, you spoke to Luca Guarcellina. At the finish, he is Trek Segafredo general manager, and they've still got a lot to fight for in this Giro. Giulio Ciccone is still riding very well And Nibali gave it a good go today.
Well, another direct sportif, Rich, or another team manager in Lucas' case, who obviously had a view on what happened with the stage, it being shortened this morning. And also, as you say, it was a pretty good day for Ciccone. And we also saw Vincenzo Nibali rallying today, didn't we? We expect some kind of a flick of the shark's fin before the end of the Giro. And we sort of saw that today. We saw it live. We were on La Crosetta where it happened.
Well, Luca, let's start at the beginning and this morning. Did you go to the start today expecting to do the full route, or did you already know that it was going to be shortened?
No, we thought that we were going to do the full road, especially because we got information that normally everything was clean and okay. But then there at the start to arrive news that, even from organizers, that the top of the mountain there was light snow and so on. So at the end was a common decision to don't take the start. On the original parcours, and to have the shortened one, probably I think was the best choice at this point.
Did it seem to you as though most of the teams, if not all of the teams, all of the riders were unanimous?
No, as usual. No, I mean, it's clearly, I mean, I believe for the teams, I mean, teams, we were probably all in line to take the start or few small modification. But between the riders, we know we are here with 200 guys and each one has his own priority. So it's way more difficult to have them having one common idea. But at the end, it was such a difficult day and decision that I believe it's been already tough like this. I could not imagine with this weather how it could have been to make the four pass.
And I guess after what happened last year, what everyone really wanted to avoid was a mess whereby a decision is taken at the last minute.
Exactly. I mean, on the bus this morning we discussed, we say, okay guys, once we step down from the bus, a decision should have been made and we move and we stick to the plan. Otherwise, for the public especially, it's not nice to see sort of a strike or protest. And I think at the end there was the right moment to take the right decision.
And tactically today on the road, the attack from Vincenzo, was that planned or was it a kind of spontaneous prova d'orgoglio? What was it?
We planned the attack, you know. We would like really to have a big group going and have a chance to go for the stage. But obviously when you see that there's Almeida and Formolo that they are so close to the classement, we knew it was complicated to go to the finish. So then we tried to make another selection, but then again Almeida was there, so we knew that it was very complicated to go to the finish. So at the end, Vincenzo, when we realized that the main peloton was coming back, he slowed down a bit and tried to give the last pull to Giulio, and that's it. I mean, you know, that was the plan. We make it, and I think so far it was not bad.
And just finally, with Giulio over the next few days, he's never really ridden general classification for 3 weeks before. Do you really want to see him continue to do that? Or, I mean, I know he's very aggressive. I mean, is his impulse, is his desire to maybe try something spectacular, try to win a stage?
As you said, his first time he's really going for GC, so we need to support him as well now. Clearly need to keep control and see who he can follow, who cannot. Now the podium is a bit far, but so far, you know, 4-6 is very, very close game. Let's say 4-7. So let's see after the rest day how it goes. And then I think that that will be our priority. Obviously, if we see that there's the opportunity, we always take it, you know. And that's what we came here with, this attitude, and we'll keep going with that.
That was Luca Guercellena. Again, if you're interested in Luca Guercellena, an episode of From Our Giro. It was Daniel in conversation with Luca, and a very interesting man he is too. Let's hear now, shall we, from a very tired, bedraggled James Knox, just craving crisps and beer. I can relate to that.
In the hotel now. Would have done my audio diary previously, but I felt pretty sick in the bus. We had the... I had to do a couple of climbs. It was quite long, quite twisty. Bus was pretty hot. Felt pretty horrible. Had some crisps and peanuts and beer to drown out the day. Really hard day. Scary how much harder it could have been. Trembling at the thought of what would have been if we had to go over Fedea and Pardoi. But yeah, it was just a bit of a mess, to be honest. I'm going to put my neck on the line and say it's just a bit of a fiasco, the whole thing. You know, we only found out in the bus. Literally, we were supposed to be going to sign on at 10:25, more or less, something like that. Not that it matters now, obviously. I mean, personally, wasn't really like the decision was in my hands, and you know, I wasn't someone. I was just going to try and get on with it either way. Sort of mentally prepared, and also prepared clothing-wise to do the big one. I was 5 layers deep, hot cream everywhere, wearing as much clothes as I could. Not that that changed anything, really. But yeah, just to be fine out so late, it's a bit annoying. And I can't help but feel like there's a little bit of a, again, don't want to be controversial, but there's just a bit of a, no one wants to take responsibility for it, particularly, I mean, from the rider's point of view, it seems like the organisation, even though they did make the call in the end, like to just sort of make it seem like the riders are the bad guys, demanding the race got shortened, when I think the conversation started much earlier about the race looking like a bit of a disaster to climb over 2,300 metres a couple of times and over 2,000 metres 3 times in the race, to which I think it was mainly replied with, no, no, it's fine, it's going ahead, it's going ahead. Last night we heard it was going ahead. Yeah, even though there's a bit of rumbling on the CPA group and asking of a vote, yeah, all we hear is from the organisation, the race is going ahead. I guess as a rider, even despite this CPA and a little bit of group chat organisation, not much you feel like you can do. Maybe it wasn't as bad as forecasted in the end. It was very, very, very cold. I did survive okay with how much I had, but still frozen, riding down into Cortina, and that was just one high descent. I really dread to think if I would have gotten round frozen, you know, coming over for day and then have to crawl back up Podoy just to do it all over again. And, you know, I see everything on Twitter. We're not, you know, the riders aren't, you know, we're aware of all the outside noise. We seem to be getting slated by and large. I guess it's a little bit disheartening to read, you know. I feel like, especially having a hard time, you know. It's not like we're going out there and having a jolly. But public love the suffer fest, don't they, you know? Like, I mean, I think we would have seen 60 guys out the race. I don't know, is abandoning the race, frozen, being unable to pedal, getting in cars, worst case scenario is getting shipped off in ambulances or stopped by the road with hypothermia, is that, I don't know if that's ideal. Just seen that thing in China where that ultramarathon went tits up, things can go wrong. It's not, it isn't very nice. There is riders scattered over an hour of the course, not everyone's got support and whatever, and it's hard enough to use the radios when the cars are nearby, so let alone if you're on your own. So yeah. And after all that, the race was barely even on TV, because I think it was a bit of a spectacle. I don't know if it would have changed drastically. You know, maybe it would have just been a couple more explosions and tune on the TV a bit later. Because from what I understand, and yeah, Joao did a fantastic race up the road, drove the breakaway with some strong guys. They went away. From his own words, Bernal just came flying past him, and yeah, there wasn't anything he could do. But sounds like Bernal again showed his class, showed his ability. Some more daylight between the other guys, even if he took the descent easy and they brought him back a little bit. But yeah, Remco wasn't enjoying it much, to be honest. He had a mechanical on the first climb, and that was a bit of a disaster also. Joao was going up the road, there's obviously not much anyone could do. Mikkel, yesterday's crash was hurting, and also dropped, so I was sort of dangling at the back of what was a very splintered group, trying to help. But at the same time, petrified that if I actually went any back further, I wouldn't, you know, and it kicked off again, I also wouldn't be there. So can't say I did much, but sort of gave me a little bit of hand for that last 200 metres or whatever to get back to the group. But that was all on the first climb. And then from there, tried to keep a bit of morale. But yeah, he was hurting, I think, as we can all see on the results. Didn't go very well when EF took it on, set a strong pace before we even got to the Jow. Do know these roads. Some Ionica drag stage here. We did training camp in Passo San Pellegrino last year, so basically knew all the roads. Yeah, not that made it any easier, but yeah, as soon as the F put the hammer down, gaps are forming, and we tried to close it before we even hit properly the climb before Passo Jao. And then yeah, did sort of see it was over, and we ended up just riding as a foursome in a bit of our own gruppetto, taking our time, trying to save Remco a bit. Thankfully, I had some hot drinks and stuff from the car throughout the day. I mean, other than Jao, I shouldn't be so despondent, should I? He's riding a fantastic ride. He moved himself up to 10th. But obviously, from my perspective of the day, it was pretty hard, miserable day. Rest day tomorrow. Steak for dinner. Big lion tomorrow morning. It's supposed to rain, so I won't be riding my bike outside. Probably won't ride my bike. Take a bit of a kick in on Wednesday, but would love a day off. I'm pretty done. Need something to bounce back with. Yeah, I don't know if I said, but we're in Canazai, bottom of Podoy. I think that's all. I'm going to enjoy maybe another beer tonight for dinner. Hopefully some chips with the steak, or try and get a packet of crisps or something. Love a packet of crisps. Top of the ones I've already had on the bus. And then, yeah, getting a little bit closer slowly, but not having the greatest of Giros. And the Giro isn't exactly treating us either. So there you go. You suffer and you learn from it. At least you try to.
Well, that was James Knox. Another riveting installment from James. He's not having the greatest Giro. And, you know, this is the third audio diary he's kept for us. The first one was at the Vuelta where he was fighting to finish in the top 10. Second one was at the Giro where they had the pink jersey for a lot of the race. So a lot to ride for there. And it was, those were both pretty positive experiences. I have to say credit to James for keeping the diary going every night when he's not having the best of times here. Things are not going so well for him or his team. So we're very grateful to him for sending in these installments every night and really laying his soul bare. And it was very interesting to hear him talk about, you know, the failure to take responsibility by anybody for this decision. And that was my impression too. It's interesting that you mentioned this race in China, which I talked to you about earlier, Daniel. 21 runners died in extreme weather in China in an endurance race. And I think hypothermia was a factor there. You know, these things can happen. Not saying that that would happen on a race like the Giro, but, you know, we shouldn't dismiss completely the health concerns.
Now, what's interesting, just to elaborate on something we said earlier, is that the worlds of professional sport and amateur sport are diverging in this respect, because these sort of survivalist events, these last man standing events, particularly in things like ultra running, ultra trail running. If you look at events like Badwater and
Marathon des Sables,
but they are becoming, you know, from sort of 100 kilometers having been an extremely long way, and the sort of the gold standard for ultra trail races. Now there are many that are over 200 kilometers, 300 kilometers, 400 kilometers, and these events sell out, and there's massive demand on the part of amateur athletes to take part in these events. And professional sport is, for reasons we said earlier, because of its changing nature, and also because it's a product that's constructed for television.
Which it wasn't. And you know, the Tour de France was established by Henri de Grange as an extreme endurance event. And it's changed. And it's something different now. We should wrap things up,
We should,
Daniel.
Richard. Tonight, there's going to be no update on my odyssey through the long, stringy pastas of central and even northern Italy. But I'm hoping that we might get some canederli tonight, which are very typical of this region. They're sort of dumplings, kind of like gnocchi, but a bit bigger, made with stale bread, cheese. I think the cheese is called Puzzone di Moena, which is just up the road, Moena. Spinach you get in there. What else is on? A bit of speck. So I'm hoping we will have some of those tonight.
We better go pretty quickly, because it's time's getting
when
on.
Things tend to shut down more quickly earlier.
Oh my
here,
goodness.
Don't they? Because
right, well, let's wrap things up quickly. Like, we can't miss dinner. Culture. We can't miss dinner, or we'll be on the crisps and beer like James Knox. Thanks very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.